Accession number 4847, Reel 1.
Major Irwin, Reel 1.
Could you tell me, first of all, Major Irwin, when you first joined the services?
I first joined the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers, the 5th Battalion of the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers, at the age of 18 in 1936, stationed in Walker-on-Tyne, and that battalion had been commanded by my father during the First World War and subsequently. I was determined to become a territorial soldier in my father's regiment as close as possible to my 18th birthday, which was on October the 27th, 1936. In fact, my first commission came through, I think it was about November the 11th, 1936. And I was in commerce at that time and very unhappy about being in commerce. And in the year 1937, I took a Territorial Army course at Sandhurst, and one evening we were asked by the Royal Northumberland Fusilier regular instructor at Sandhurst, then a Captain Martin, whom I met the other day at the age of 81 at our regimental reunion, who'd done superbly well, who was absolutely terrific. I hadn't seen him since that particular night in 1937. And at that meet, at that little party after dinner, I met a captain in the Gurkha Rifles. I'll give you his name in a minute. And I went back home and then was quite determined that I was going to become a regular officer. It necessitated me taking the Territorial Army and supplementary reserve examination for entry into the regular army. They only took about 30 candidates at that time. I went to a crammer in Farnham, a Captain Yates. By the way, the name of that captain was Captain RCO Headley. He was in the 5th Gurkha Rifles. And I was determined that then, Charles, I was going to join the 5th Gurkha Rifles. Headley became a Major General and did extremely well. So I took the exam with very, very considerable difficulty through the crammer, and I happened to come out sixth in the exam, sixth out of 150 candidates in 1939, I think it was, in the middle of 1939. I had hoped to get a vacancy to go to Headley's regiment, to the Gurkha Rifles, but they only gave the two vacancies to officers who had had relatives and associations with the Indian Army. So I failed to get into the Indian Army, and I joined a regular battalion of my regiment, the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers, at Connaught Barracks in Dover. It would appear that I displayed a certain aptitude for machine gun instruction, and I was subsequently posted to the depot of the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers at Fenham Barracks in Newcastle-upon-Tyne.
Which barracks?
Fenham Barracks, Newcastle-upon-Tyne, which was the depot of the Durham Light Infantry and the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers. And that very briefly is the way I came to join the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers. I may say here that officers who entered the army from the Territorial Army and the Supplementary Reserve, who really had had to sweat and cram on their own to do that exercise, were not allowed to get commissions until they were aged 21, and they all had to take seniority below those officers who entered from Sandhurst, irrespective of their ability.
Now, at this time, you soon went to France. Can you tell me how that came about?
Yes, that's a very interesting story. I was a machine gun instructor at Fenham Barracks, instructing officers of all ranks, officers and other, all ranks. And I was fed up with being at Fenham Barracks, and an Army Council instruction came out asking for officers to go to the Royal Air Force Army Cooperation Squadrons. And so I applied for this. My father, who, as I say, had done extremely well in the First World War, I suppose he was 26 when he commanded a battalion, the 5th Battalion of the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers, and the man whom I greatly admired from that standpoint, although he was an extremely hard disciplinarian, he was extremely annoyed with me for having applied to go to the Air Force to see some form of activity. Nevertheless, it happened that one evening my father and mother and I were having dinner at Tilly's Restaurant in Newcastle to celebrate the 30th, 40th, 50th anniversary of Miller, the restaurant's manager. And as we were sitting there, an officer with the rank of major and the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers walked across and said to my father, "Good evening, Colonel." And it was a man called Tommy Thomas. Tommy Thomas had served for a short period of time with my father in the First War. I think my father had temporarily commanded a brigade, and I think that maybe Thomas had been his brigade major for a very short period of time. I felt very much like saying, "Well, sir, when you get a brigade or you get a battalion, perhaps you'll take me along with you so that I can be to you as you were to my father." Well, it so happened that very shortly after that, Tommy Thomas, a regular officer, was given command of the 9th Battalion, the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers, a second line territorial to the 7th Battalion of the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers. I think perhaps he was given command one evening, and the following day he called me into his office and said, "Charles, you will be promoted captain." I went from second lieutenant to captain, and you will come with me to France. As soon as things get sorted out there, you will become my adjutant. I was then aged 21 and a half. As it was, I was to go out as his training officer.
Can you tell me about your duties once you got to France and what you saw there?
Yes, I crossed to France on April the 23rd, 1940. I stress that it was April the 23rd because April the 23rd is St. George's Day, and St. George is the patron saint of the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers. Every St. George's Day, we celebrate that day. We wear red and white roses. Don't ask me the reason why, but we do. And it is interesting that my father crossed to France on April the 23rd, 1915. Exactly 25 years later, I was to cross to France. My father was wounded at the Battle of St. Julian, and he came back to England and subsequently went back to France, and I went on into Germany 5 to 6 weeks later. When we got to France, we were placed into a tented orchard. We were a motley crew, I would say, a second-line territorial battalion. We were to train in machine gunnery. There were four regiments, machine gun regiments, in the British Army at that time, of which there were the Thumb Fusiliers, the Cheshire Regiment, the Middlesex Regiment, and one other. There was one other. And we trained, we dug. I don't think we acted very efficiently. In fact, as the years have gone by, I came to understand, indeed I understood then, that we really were not preparing for real war.
In what specific sense was it not efficient?
It was unrealistic. I don't think we might have been preparing for the 1914-18 type of war, but we weren't hard. I don't think we were really disciplined. I don't think we could really march 25 or 26 miles as I was to do in the days succeeding May the 10th, 1940. As a free man and subsequently as a prisoner, I think it was all regarded as a bit of fun. I have subsequently studied, indeed I was to study and lecture in Germany about this, and I'm quite convinced that we were extremely poorly prepared for war.
Was this is this mental preparation you're talking about, or material preparation, or
mental,
both?
Physical and material, in every respect. I don't think there was a degree of hardness within us at that time. I don't think there was a degree of realism or hardness. For instance, it was absolute madness that I should have taken to war with me a beautiful leather suitcase. I can see it now, and I can see the Germans taking it away, a beautiful leather suitcase which my uncle, a surgeon in Newcastle, had given to me on my 21st birthday on October 27th in 1939. We were not equipped. We were physically not equipped. We took far too much paraphernalia with us. The degree of training wasn't hard enough for what was to come, and for which we should certainly have been prepared.
Do you think this was because the hostilities were not seriously anticipated?
I think it's perhaps because hostilities weren't anticipated. We were a second-line territorial division, so I suppose we were in the third echelon. You had the regular army, you had the first-line territorial army divisions and battalions. Then you had the second line. But looking back at it now, I think the British Army, and I'm a student of military history, and I used to lecture on it as a prisoner of war, I think the British Army of 1914 was certainly superior to that of 1939-40, the army which went into action in 1940. And the other day, about 3 years ago, I was asked to lecture to a guards battalion about life as a prisoner of war, and I was enormously impressed with the discipline, the intelligence, and the general behavior of the men with whom I spoke. And I suspect that the army today is probably the best of the three armies which this nation has had.
When hostilities did actually break out, did there seem to be any surprise on the part of you and your comrades?
Yes, there was considerable surprise. It happened, I can see it now. It happened on the morning of May the 10th, 1940, about 5 o'clock. We saw the aeroplanes in the sky, and we sort of said, well, this is it. Bombs started to drop, not too close to us. We weren't affected by it. And then it happened at about 5 o'clock in the morning. And then it came up on the radio that the thing had started.
Can you describe how what happened to you from then on?
Yes. It's really so much of a dream now, and so unrealistic that it's very difficult to describe. I suppose we were there in that same place for maybe 2 days. I do recall going for a hell of a party into Arras one night. Arras, of course, is well known because it had been the headquarters of the British Army, GHQ, in the First World War, and Arras was a well-known city, and I had studied a lot about Arras and its battles in my studies of military history. We went in and we had a hell of a party, which indicates the state of discipline, and the state of preparedness which there was. My next memories are of being marched to and fro across areas around Arras, Merville, Doulens, Saint-Omer, and seemingly getting nowhere. I remember one time having, I suppose, crossed the German lines. Of course, as you know, we were in the rear areas, and the thrusts from, as I was subsequently to know, from Kleist and Guderian's armies were to come up behind us and cut us. I suppose I crossed that line, although I didn't know it, and I remember seeing Tommy, the CO, Tommy Thomas, a wonderful chap, marvellous man, and it saying that I'd been on the go for days and that I'd like a bit of sleep, and he said, well, you can get 3 or 4 hours sleep now, always get it when you can. And then going back and then seeing ourselves depleted, I don't know why, people fell out, and eventually I found myself with 7 men, 6 men and myself, in the main square. In fact, it's not the main square, it's the second main square in the town of Saint-Omer. And maybe I can no longer recall. I doubt if I could even recall after it all happened in May of 1940. It was all so shattering. We went into the, found ourselves in the second main square in Saint-Omer, and stupid boy that I was, I said, I must get a separate room for myself. I must see that the men are put right, but I must get a separate place for myself, which I managed to do. I still had all my paraphernalia on this 1500 weight truck, all the idiotic things I'd taken to France with me, the totally unnecessary extra accessories, not even accessories, baggage. And we parked the truck, they went to sleep, I went to sleep. That must have been on the night of May the 19th. We got up, we heard shelling. We got up on the morning of May the 20th to make our way out of Saint-Omer to where I wouldn't know this, then nor at this time. Anyway, to make our way out. As we drove down the road out from the square, at the bottom there was a German tank which immediately fired at us, wounding the chap who was on my left, the fusilier. How we managed to turn to the right, I don't know, and get back into the main square, I still don't know. And eventually I said, well, we'll have to leave the truck down here. We will take the machine gun, the drill purpose machine gun, onto the first floor of the bank, which overlooked the main square. We will go in there and we'll see what happens. So we knocked on the door. Madam, the bank manager, opened the door, and I said, we are coming in. And so we made our way onto the six of us onto the first floor of the bank, and Madam left us. She had a Fiat car down below with which we barricaded the door, and we prepared to make battle from the windows of the first floor of the bank. We had of course all my, I could see the truck down below in which were all our belongings, the 1500 weight truck, all our belongings were located. Then I know that these drill purpose machine guns frequently didn't fire. They'd had the I've forgotten the strikers, which for drill purpose guns are taken out or filed down. They'd put new strikers in, but they frequently didn't work. And we had little or nothing apart from this wretched gun. We had nothing ourselves. Madam had told us that there was no water. We had a couple of tins of peas, a couple of tins of pineapples, a bottle of port and a bottle of wine, I think there was, and no water. And one wounded soldier, one wounded fusilier. And the next thing I knew was a German motorcyclist appeared in the square, and I said, hold your fire until we see what happens. Before I could say Jack Robinson, the square was full of tanks, and I realized we had the tank, the gun, our gun was no use against the tank. So I said, okay, pull it down, we will now wait for the counterattack. And so from May the 20th until May the 26th, the six of us, seven of us, crawled around that room, waiting for the counterattack. I would hear the sound of aeroplanes, and I would look out, thinking that perhaps it was aeroplanes belonging to us, but they were always German aeroplanes. And I believed at that time that there would be a counterattack, and that we couldn't possibly be let down. But of course, we had little to drink, little to eat. The two tins of peas, the two tins of pineapples, the bottle of wine and the bottle of port. And on the afternoon of May the 26th, of course we were surrounded by Germans. I knew I could see them down in the square, all around us. On the afternoon of May the 26th, there was a knocking and banging on the door down below. Eventually, Madam came up the stairs, followed by the Germans. They banged the door down, and with their bayonets up went our hands, and we were prisoners of war. They led us round. They separated me from the others. They led us round, or led me round, to some headquarters in the main square, behind our smaller square. And the German Sonderführer translator said to me, as they all did then, "For you the war is over. We are now in Boulogne." And I said to him, "You mustn't talk to me like that. I don't believe a word of what you say. That is quite impossible." Of course it was true. And they asked me the usual questions. I gave my name, my rank, I think, and my number. I think that was it. And we then proceeded, I joined others, and proceeded to march and be cattle tracked into Germany.
What was the demeanor of the German troops who captured you?
The German troops who captured us behaved extremely well. I was absolutely shattered. I couldn't believe that this had happened. I believed, as I've written and told you, I believed in the invincibility of the British Empire. I just did not believe that this could happen. And of course, none of us had had any training whatsoever for what to do in the case that we were prisoners of war. In fact, I admit quite freely now, and even then, that I wasn't altogether too sure where Saint-Omer was. There was a tremendous shortage of maps. There was complete chaos, particularly in the rear areas. So I was a shattered man.
What was the journey into Germany like?
The journey into Germany, we marched, I suppose, at times 20 to 25 miles a day. We slept out. We just marched. I recall being given biscuits to eat. We of course became weaker and weaker. I suppose we drank water. We were then put onto cattle trucks. 40 hommes, 8 chevaux, 40 men, 8 horses. Many more than 40 men into a cattle truck. I recall passing through Trier and for some time being stationary in the railway station there. It's interesting that about 4 years ago I happened to be in Trier on a Sunday afternoon with my wife and son, and I said to them, "The last time I was here was in June 1940 in a cattle truck going into Germany. We went a cattle truck from Trier to the Ronglaufen, which was in the other side of Germany, the eastern side of Germany, and eventually we landed up at a place called Laufen in Oberbayern, Upper Bavaria, just across the river from Austria. Of course, there was no frontier then. About 25 miles from Salzburg.